So we're going to cover the last of these six items that are destructive of bhakti. Adhyahara, prayasascha prajalpo niyamagraha, janasangascha, what's the last one? Lolyam. Lolyam. What is the meaning of lolyam? Who knows the meaning? Lolyam. Yeah. Restless of the mind, greed and desires. Those are three dictionary definitions. Restlessness of the mind, greed, and desires, meaning material desires. Lolyam. So, this is a very detailed and I find beautiful, I think that's an appropriate word, beautiful description by Bhaktivinoda Thakur of this subject. So, I hope you all listen very, very attentively, even though it's just after prasadam. So he goes through these three categories of lolyam, starting with restlessness. And he says that there's two kinds of restlessness. There's restlessness of the mind and restlessness of the intelligence. Restlessness of the mind is of two kinds. Restlessness of the mind results from bringing the mind in contact with objects of the senses in the mood of enjoyment. Krishna describes that in Bhagavad Gita. What happens when we bring objects in contact with the senses in the mood of enjoyment? Yehi samsparsha ja bhoga dukha yonaya evate. Bhoga, in the mood of enjoyment, the objects of the senses and the senses meet. But in the mind, there is the anticipation of enjoyment. The opposite comes. Dukkha yonaya evate. So, we develop either attachment for that object. You contemplate an object in the mood of enjoyment, develop an attachment for it, or the opposite, an aversion. That's the commonplace material situation of lolyam. The mind becomes restless and it keeps moving back and forth between attachment and aversion. So he suggests that the solution to that problem is by medium of devotional service or by the grace of Bhakti Devi. If one takes those tendencies that we have for being attached to something and learn the art of connecting that something in a theistic way, connecting that something to the Supreme, then we transfer that attachment to the Supreme. Then it becomes helpful for the path of bhakti. Now there's obviously some things that you can't transfer in the service to the Supreme. So those things are forbidden objects or forbidden activities. But those that are not, we can dovetail them, connect them to somehow serving the Supreme. I gave the example the other day of Prabhupada speaking about some Western disciples getting the idea that they could make Western music and somehow glorify Krishna through Western music. He wasn't appreciating that in particular, but he approved it. Now there's some devotees, I guess he's a little famous. There's one rap, I guess you would call him a singer, but I, you know, just noisemaker, rap music. So there's in Detroit, there's one devotee that's very famous in the rap music circuit, and it's all Krishna rap. And he's famous. He sells a lot of records doing Krishna rap. It's write-ups about being into this cool thing of being into Krishna rap. As far as I guess, it's probably the same kind of noisy stuff that you hear when people are passing by in their cars blaring that rap music and their whole car is rocking with that stuff. Roll the windows up. But I'll share this one with you. There, in our New Jersey temple, there's a group of kids that have graduated from the Sunday school, and now they're in their high school age, and so they've formed their own little kind of youth group. And four of the kids, there was a survey done by one of the, you know, the leaders of that. Of those teenagers, what are the things that you'd like to do? So four of them want to do some kind of music. So I saw them one day when they were getting their first get together and asked what kind of music they're going to play, like fusion music or, you know, traditional, you know, what kind of music? And they said, well, a combination between, I forget what they said it was. Rock and something. I said, Krishna rock. Like Krishna rap. You know, I don't. Anyway, that's what they wanted to do. So, if they didn't do that for Krishna, then they probably would do it not for Krishna. Or at least be hankering to do it not for Krishna. Yeah, anyway, those of you that have teenage children, boys or girls, or know others that do, know what this whole phenomena is of being attracted to music. Right? You have that in the house here, Suresh? Attraction to music?
Yes.
Mildly.
Because all the time we have questions are on.
No, but through association at school, the kids do that stuff. They don't listen to bhajans at school. They listen to other stuff. Anyway, in some homes, I know it's a thing. So if you just say no, then that means yes. So how to make? Anyway, the principle that he's presenting here is. Lulyam, or the restless mind that becomes attracted to some type of sense gratification, if there is some way that that legitimately can be directed towards. Anyway, so there's, you get the idea. That's kind of in the mode of passion and ignorance category, but learning some classical instrument with the school piano or clarinet or flute or something. But so learning some kind of skill, but somehow they've done this in Seattle. They had the kids form a little band, and the instruments that the kids perform in the school band, someone brings their saxophone and someone brings their this and someone brings their that, and they have a little band. They call it the something or other band, Gopal band or something like that. And then they practice singing bhajans, and then they performed at the Sunday feast doing their Gopal band performance. Anyway, somehow connecting something, the principle that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is indicating. Ideally, if the spirit is dedicating that to serve Krishna somehow, then one's senses will become purified by the dedication to Krishna part. And attraction in course of time for something that's actually more pleasing to Krishna than Krishna rap and Krishna rock and Krishna noise, but something that's more pleasing with instruments that Krishna likes being performed in a manner that Krishna likes. So that disposition will Krishnaize that tendency. So then he indicates that, however, this is a way that the restless mind can be made peaceful, but that's not going to be possible if the intelligence is restless. It's just like we can have a clear understanding about something that we can do to help our senses be directed more towards pleasing Krishna. But if our intelligence is restless, we won't stay with that notion. We'll go to the next thing and next thing and next thing. So then he explores how this problem of a restless intelligence can be corrected. And he points to the verse of Bhagavad Gita 3:42, where Krishna describes a hierarchy. Indriyani paranyahor, the senses are superior to dull matter, the mind is superior to the senses, intelligence is superior to mind, and the soul is above all the rest. So there's a way he outlines, and I'm going to read it because it's hard to replicate it, plus it's done so nicely, how the intelligence can be made steady. It starts at the top of page 43. Bhagavad Gita 2:55 and 56, the translation. Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O Partha, when a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, and when his mind, thus purified, finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness, one who is not disturbed in mind, even amidst the threefold miseries, or elated when there is happiness, and who is freed from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of steady mind. These two verses from the Gita clarify the process of tolerating the urges of speech, mind, and anger, as recommended in the first verse of Sri Upadesha Amrita. So the first verse of Sri Upadesha Amrita is one who can tolerate the urges of vacho vegam, urge of speech, manasa, mind, krodha, anger, jiva, the tongue, etc. So this is the conditional, using Bhaktivinoda Thakur's language, the conditional side, that is counteracting or minimizing that force of the material energy. Then he quotes this verse, Indriyani paranyahor indriyevya paramanaha, etc. The intelligence also pervertedly accepts materialism only when under the control of the false ego. When under the control of the pure ego, in the form of identifying oneself as the servant of Krishna, the intelligence is always naturally pure. So he's indicating there's material and spiritual intelligence. Therefore, the Vedas establish that the knower of the body is intelligence. Listen to this sentence. That spirit soul is higher than the intelligence, because intelligence is only the soul's propensity. The soul that can understand his real identity as spirit soul and doesn't misidentify with the coverings of the soul, that soul can be said to be situated above the intelligence, because intelligence is only the soul's propensity. So the soul is the place where free will is situated. The seat of our free will is the soul itself. Krishna doesn't interfere with our free will. Souls are minute, but they have some minute free will. And if we will to act in relation to Krishna, then that propensity of the soul is reciprocated with by Krishna supplying spiritual intelligence. The dami udiyogam tam yena mam upiyanti te. And if the soul, by exercising free will, says, no, I don't want to enjoy with Krishna, I want to enjoy apart from Krishna, then we're awarded material intelligence. Thus, intelligence is nothing but the propensity of the soul, or an instrument for the soul to act through to achieve either the spiritual or material inclinations. So the restless intelligence, that's material intelligence. Bahushaka yanantascha. And the spiritual intelligence is singular, it's very focused, not restless. Yavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana. So here's he's indicating. If you want the mind to be not restless, the mind has to be directed toward Krishna. But what's going to direct the mind toward Krishna? That's spiritual intelligence. Material intelligence is not going to direct the mind toward Krishna. Spiritual intelligence will, but that's by the reflection of the soul. It's but the soul's propensity, spiritual intelligence or material intelligence. Interesting, huh? So lolium, with the meaning of restlessness, that's one of the three meanings. Restlessness on the material side is conquered by being spiritually fixed, by choosing with our free will to take shelter of Krishna, or to try to please Krishna. I don't want to please Krishna, I want to enjoy apart from Krishna. Then we're awarded material intelligence. That material intelligence is restless, and then the mind is restless, and the senses are all over the place, and we have material life. That's the package. It all starts with the choice of the free will of the soul, and then which intelligence we're awarded is depending upon that choice. Remember this phrase, intelligence is only the soul's propensity. I'll read on. When a living entity realizes himself as a pure spiritual particle, then his spiritual ego, in the form of identifying himself as the servant of Krishna, naturally arises. At that time, the intelligence in its pure form rejects materialism and accepts spiritualism. At that time, a living entity has no desire other than the service of Krishna, and he rejects material desires as insignificant. In this position, the living entity is known as Siddha Pragya, transcendentally situated. Siddha Pragya, intelligence being transcendentally situated, spiritual intelligence. Or yavasayatmika buddhi, spiritual intelligence, sthita pragya. I was studying this in the little anecdote. I was studying, but it helps illustrate the meaning of the verse. In the month of January, I knew that I was going to be here in the month of May. So while I was taking Panchakarma treatment in Bombay, I was taking time to study Bhaktivinoda Thakur Sri Bhaktiloka. And during that time I was visiting the Ayurvedic physician that I had been seeing for a number of years. A very, very accomplished Ayurvedic physician, but he's very much in the mode of goodness, but doesn't have any sadhana, any direct spiritual sadhana. So naturally, he's going to be limited in what he's going to be able to do for himself or for others. And sometimes he recognizes that, and sometimes he doesn't recognize that, which means he doesn't recognize it. So he invited me to come take a look at some very, 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 very ancient manuscripts that are thousands of years old, that give very, very ancient teachings in Ayurveda. Not from Dhanvantari's time, that's another yuga, but very, very ancient Sanskrit and Tibetan writings giving detailed formulas about Ayurvedic treatments in different categories, and some of them are on the emotional. What Ayurvedic treatments can be done to help people become very emotionally balanced, and some that can help them become physiologically balanced, and some that focus on the heart, and some that focus on other essential organs of the body. So he was very excited to show them to me, one by one, pulling them out of these very, very ancient wrappers. And I mean, obviously they're authentically very old. So he started speaking about how through Ayurveda, when one gets all of these good balances and so forth, that one can come to the stage of citta pragya. And I surprised myself. I just blurted it out, "No!" Because I normally don't do that with him. And I said, "You know, it's not according to Bhagavad Gita what you're saying. Because citta pragya means transcendentally situated, where even if you can materially balance on the conditional side all these things, if you're not constitutionally situated at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you're not going to be citta pragya. You will not have steady intelligence. I'm sorry." I said it even more forcefully than I just said that. And he was going, "You're right. You're right. It can be helpful." I said, "Yeah, it can be helpful. Many things that can be helpful. I'm sure this can be also helpful. But it's not citta pragya. Transcendentally situated, you can't achieve that by some material means. You can counteract the disturbing influences in certain ways. That's unconditional influence. And so that you can use those things. They're helpful." And I reminded him of the discussion that I had with him and his wife, also an MD, that the whole Ayurvedic practice that they're taking up, while it's good, it remains good, but it won't hold its position. Like they were saying, "We can bring us somebody who has a health problem, we can help address that health problem. But if they don't change their habits, their lifestyle, they'll be back in the same position because the lifestyle got them into that problem. We can address the problem, but the lifestyle is going to generate the problem again. And therefore we need people like you, Maharaj, to come and train our staff how to be spiritually centered and have good habits spiritually speaking, because that's going to come out materially speaking for the better or for the worse." But he uses this distinction by saying what I think it's here. What material intelligence does, no, it's not in this section. I'm jumping ahead to another section, but material intelligence looks at what's materially good and bad. And spiritual intelligence looks at what's spiritually good and spiritually bad. From the spiritual perspective, all spiritually good and spiritually bad things are bad. Excuse me. All materially good things and materially bad things are bad if they're devoid of God consciousness. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, from the highest planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest planet, all are undesirable. Because therein repeated birth and death take place. They're all bad or undesirable. That's spiritual intelligence. And material intelligence says, Brahmaloka is better than Patalaloka. The lifestyle that leads to goodness is better than the lifestyle that leads to ignorance and passion. That's true from the material intelligence point of view. And knowledge in the mode of ignorance says Patalaloka is better than Brahmaloka. And the lifestyle of destruction and wanton living is the way to go. Not this lifestyle of regulation and goodness. So there's different kinds of material intelligence. We can, from as devotees who are trying to serve, are trying to please Krishna, we can take help from our material intelligence. We can use it in Krishna's service as long as we don't get used by it to take us away from Krishna's service. That can also happen. I've seen that happen, where devotees that have really good material intelligence intelligently convince themselves that devotional service is something that they cannot or will not, or something. They convince themselves with their material intelligence to go away from Krishna and have a whole rationale. Obviously the rationale is filled with holes, but in their own frame of looking at the world, it works for them with their material intelligence. Anyway, steady, this restlessness, this lolium, is addressed by becoming stitta pragya or stitta di muni. So stitta di muni indicates where the mind is controlled because the intelligence is controlled. When the intelligence is controlled, when it's controlled by the soul. When we're spiritually situated, then we have intelligence. So let's read it. Being empowered by the spiritual potency. Okay. When a living entity has no desire other than the service to Krishna, he rejects material desires as insignificant. In this position, stitta pragya, transcendentally situated, or stitta di, steady-minded. Being empowered by spiritual potency, the intelligence then becomes steady and controls the mind and heart by regulating them. Then the mind, under the direction of the intelligence, controls the senses by regulating them. And a favorable mood for devotional service manifests in the sense objects. Wow. In other words, material nature reciprocates with the desires of the living entities. If the living entity is pure in devotion, situations favorable within the material energy to serve Krishna manifest themselves. Or, Prabhupada was once asked, Swamiji, what will happen if everyone becomes Krishna conscious? Prabhupada said, they will never. But what if they did, Swamiji? Then he said, this place would become Vaikuntha. It's not like, you know, Naperville, Vaikuntha. But the material objects, we fashion things with our material intelligence, but if we're operating with spiritual intelligence, we will fashion things, or let's say, at it more precisely, Prakriti will align itself under the direction of the super soul to be more conducive for spiritual consciousness. The spiritual atmosphere will be created by our Krishna consciousness, reflected in material objects. So that whole sequence, starting with how we direct our free will, we're given, if we direct toward Krishna, we're given spiritual intelligence, which then directs the mind, which then directs the senses, which then in turn infuses the material energy with spiritually conducive situations. And he's indicating this is not possible through dry renunciation. It's not possible through, we can't attain those things through other processes other than through the bhakti process, because it connects us with the internal potency of Krishna. Very scientific, huh? This is spiritual technology. One should spiritualize the senses and control them with the mind, and one should spiritualize the mind and control it with the intelligence. By this process, lobha, in the form of restlessness of the intelligence and mind, is vanquished. Then he goes back the other way. When the intelligence is restless, the mind cannot be fixed. Restless intelligence wanders, sometimes in karma, sometimes in yoga, sometimes in dry renunciation, sometimes in dry knowledge. To fix the intelligence in bhakti by giving up restlessness, the Srimad Bhagavatam prescribes. So everything that he's said, is now going to be confirmed by Krishna speaking in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this will conclude this section about restlessness. It's at the top of page 45. Everything that can be achieved by fruitive activities, penance, knowledge, detachment, mystic yoga, charity, religious duties, and all other means of perfecting life is easily achieved by my devotee through loving service unto me. If somehow or other my devotee desires promotion to heaven, liberation, or residence in my abode, he easily achieves such benedictions. Because my devotees possess saintly behavior and deep intelligence, they completely dedicate themselves to me and do not desire anything besides me. Indeed, even if I offer them benediction, liberation from birth and death, they do not accept it. The devotees naturally enjoy the pleasure of my service. Unquote. Considering all this, the practicing devotee should give up lobha in the form of restlessness and attain fixed intelligence in devotional service. Now, aside from, just a comment, aside from the scriptural authority that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given, how logical, systematic, reasonable is the approach that he's taken. I feel we can, in general, the circumstances that we have to face in the West, whether it's an American audience or an Indian audience, just a modern audience here in the West, educated, thinking that they're well-informed audience. You know, people that read the New York Times and think that because they read the New York Times, they're well-informed about everything. That kind of audience, you know, they have their college degree and they read a lot. So this kind of approach that Bhaktivinoda Thakur takes is a very practical approach. Very reasoned, very calm, very peaceful, very thoughtful, not dogmatic. It addresses questions. It looks at the other side of the issue. It addresses the other side of the issue. It's very compelling. His method is very, very, I find, very effective. Although the time is like 120 or 130 years apart. And the place is obviously a different place. But the method that he uses is very effective. Okay, two more. There's volume has another meaning. The second meaning is greed. So there's a good kind of greed, he indicates, and that's also according to Rupa Goswami, and that is where one is very eager to receive Krishna's mercy. Like I mentioned yesterday evening, the Spanish Sankirtan devotee that came to my door saying, "Maharaj, blessings, so I can distribute many books today on Sankirtan." So my response was, "You're greedy. You have so many blessings. You want more blessings. How many blessings do you want?" But being that eagerness, I was teasing, and being eager for doing something nicely for Krishna, that kind of greed, that's good. Let me get some blessing, more blessings, so I can do something nice for Krishna, so that Krishna can be pleased. That's nice. But in relation to material objects or material activities, it opposes greed, opposes bhakti. He again refers to Rupa Goswami's characterization of, now moving on to the next one, that's desire. So lobium can mean restlessness, greed, and desire. When Rupa Goswami, here's a little story. When Rupa Goswami was writing his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he was living in Vrindavan, and he was visited by one very prominent acharya from another disciplic line, Vallabhacharya. Anyone here from Gujarat? You know Vallabhacharya. Vallabhacharya is from the Pushti Marg, and he spent some time in Vrindavan. In fact, when you go on the Govardhan Parikram, there's one temple that's run by the Pushti Margis, or the followers of Vallabhacharya, where they have the tongue of Govardhan, and you see many, many people going there performing abhishek, taking milk in the big goshala, and pouring milk on the tongue of Govardhan. Now, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, following Raghunath Das Goswami, there's another place, Mukharavind, a temple right by, in the town of Govardhan, where Manasi Ganga is, and that's accepted as the tongue of Govardhan by Gaudiya Vaishnavas. But in any case, when the six Goswamis were residing in Vrindavan, Vallabhacharya spent some time in Vrindavan. He and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu associated at some point in Jagannath Puri. So when Vallabhacharya was there, Rupa Goswami requested Vallabhacharya to assist him with editing, reading very carefully Nectar of Devotion or Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and asked him to read through it, and if he found anything that he felt needed some editing or some fine-tuning, please let him know. Vallabhacharya considered himself to be very scholarly. He was very happy to hear Rupa Goswami invite him to do that service. And so in the course of reading, he came across the following passage, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur quotes here in Bhakti Loka. The passage compares desire to be like two witches. The desire for bhukti, sense enjoyment, the desire for liberation, or mukti. Bhukti and mukti were compared to two witches. So Vallabhacharya came back to Rupa Goswami and said, I have a little problem with this. I think it's the language is a little strong. Two witches. Jiva Goswami, who is a disciple, he's the nephew of Rupa Goswami and his disciple, was super scholar, Jiva Goswami, and in defense of his spiritual master, Rupa Goswami, he took Vallabhacharya's comment to task and gave a whole long list of scriptural references that supported that particular use of the term, witches, to compare material desire and desire for liberation, to be like witches. And Vallabhacharya, hearing the scriptural references from Jiva Goswami, was very satisfied. Okay, this is fine. And then Rupa Goswami called Jiva Goswami to his side privately and said, why did you do this? I was just defending your name. He was saying that you made some mistake. And how is it possible, you're Rupa Goswami, to make a mistake? He wasn't saying it was a mistake. He was saying that he had some question about the particular use of the language. And you've engaged him in debate. This isn't very good. I asked for his help. He was very kind to offer his help, some service. Anyway, there's a little historical incident surrounding this particular quote that's here. On his own behalf, Jiva Goswami would have made no comment, but on behalf of his superior, he felt himself obliged to speak and spoke. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur quotes this Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu or Nectar Devotion passage where desire for sense gratification and desire for liberation are compared to two witches. And to analyze these two, he says, as long as there's desire in the heart to enjoy apart from Krishna, how is it that feelings of love are going to awaken for Krishna? Krishna will be a competitor, not the object of love. Because here's the object, which you want to enjoy, but it's to be enjoyed by Krishna. You're in competition with Krishna. Or Krishna is seen as in competition with you. So love will not awaken. Natural feelings of love will not awaken. And as far as impersonal liberation, one then reduces in that conception of life, then the personality of Godhead with all of his loving, attractive qualities and features is reduced to shunya. So where's the, how do you love shunya? So they're both opposed. These two material desires are opposed to bhakti. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that devotional service can be endlessly obstructed if these desires for separate enjoyment by sense gratification or enjoying the position of liberation without regard for Krishna. One can go on endlessly in that position. So, I'm almost done. He concludes, there's particular instructions in this regard given in Hari Bhakti Vilas for householders. And that is that the tendency for wanting enjoyment has, to a certain degree, has its place within household life. Those enjoyments should be favorable to Krishna, or where Krishna is made the object of that activity which I find enjoyable. Serving Krishna, pleasing Krishna, this is the mandate in Hari Bhakti Vilas, the principle, and the principle has its many applications. And when a householder leads their life according to that principle, it helps to make advancement, which means it helps to purify the senses, it helps to purify the mind, it helps to purify the and strengthen the intelligence by acting in that way, as opposed to trying to make it zero. And then I'm just going to read the last paragraph of this section. Page 48 at the bottom. The purport is that the liberation of a devotee in the form of freedom from bondage is easily attained by the will of Krishna. That is why one should not pollute his endeavor for devotional service with desires. So, in other words, how we repose this thing that we have desires is all important. You can pursue it, or you can try to make it zero, and neither way is going to work. If we make Krishna the object of our attempt to make enjoyment, then those desires will simultaneously be fulfilled or satisfied, but not given the prominence that they're given in material life. Rather, Krishna is given prominence, and those desires become secondary or a subset of trying to please Krishna. And this is the platform of controlling or addressing this obstacle in bhakti, namely lolya. It is the essential duty of the practicing devotee to carefully give up materialistic lolya. So that's that section. And that ends the whole first six obstacles on the path of devotion. Six faults that destroy bhakti. Okay, so any discussion on this? It was easy, right? That's nice. Everybody understand the question? No? A little history. Once upon a time, one devotee was living in Chicago, and he's no longer in Chicago. His name is Govinda, and he was helping give very, very regular and detailed instructions how he should be engaged in some service, and he found that very nice because he just would ask what he should do, and he was indicated what he should do, and he did it. He was very happy. He found the instructions were very effective, and he was very happy. Now Govinda's not there. So what should he do? Should he go bother another person, find Govinda part two? Or what? That's the question. Uh, lunch break, I was having a discussion with Gulshan about Sunday school. And I was saying that there's two approaches to Sunday school. One is that you can say, okay, kids, today we're going to do this. And they do this. And then they wait till next week, and then, okay, kids, we're going to do that. And then when the teacher's not saying, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, what do the kids do? Party time. Kids. So there's another approach, and that is helping the children understand how to make wise decisions, to choose nice devotional activities to do together, and how they're going to do them together. And so when the teacher's not there, it's not, hey, it's party time. Or when they grow up, where's the teacher? There's no teacher around. It's party time. More or less. Or when they go off to school, if everybody's doing party time, you know, they got to make a decision. Am I going to do party time or do what the school teacher said in Sunday school? And they got everybody pressuring them to do party time. Right? So there's certainly value, absolutely, because it's our descending process to be in a relationship where one is receiving instructions and very faithfully and happily, as you were describing, faithfully and happily executing those instructions. But then what happens when that situation, for some reason, there's a shift, like just happened, then. So, in some cases, we're going to have to be adults giving the same kind of association to others. In your case, to wife and children and others, and at least that much, if not, you know, others who are newcomers to Krishna consciousness besides yourself. What are you going to do? You know, ask Govinda, what should I tell them now? So in other words, the stage of maturity has to, so there's some balance. So part of training is to help someone who is being trained understand how to make those right decisions. Here's the principles by which you make those right decisions. Now I can help guide you how to make the right decisions. So, and part of that is faithful obedience. But that requires some kind of maturity to make right decisions. So there's kind of like there's a learning curve to get to that stage. So I would say from practical experience in general, plus what I know of your immediate situation, somewhere in the direction of continuing to get that kind of mentorship where there is a relationship that the person has the time and is not an imposition and you're happy to receive that direction, but at the same time that person is training you how to wisely choose, wisely engage yourself according to principles. Like those of us that were engaged in devotional service in Prabhupada's presence, some persons required Prabhupada's personally telling them, now you do this, don't do that, do this, watch out for that. And when Prabhupada was physically no longer available, a whole group of people couldn't continue in their devotional service. Right? A whole group of people just like really quickly faded because they hadn't become mature. I mean, they were faithful, but they needed Prabhupada to tell them, now do this and stop that. And immediately they did this and stopped that. You follow? Okay. I'm paralleling that situation with the immediate situation that you're addressing. And some of the rest of us had less of that one-to-one exchange, but we understood principles and were still performing according to those principles. So that's important. Faithfully abiding by those principles. Which means there's, to some degree, with some spiritual intelligence given by Krishna, those principles have been imbibed, including making necessary time, place, circumstance adjustments, but not deviating from principles. That requires a little maturity. So training will help you to be in that stage where you make wise decisions and not foolish ones, and have to learn the hard way from the foolish ones. So both have their place. In your case, I would say a little bit in the side of getting some regular instructions, but also you're being attentive, and the person who's providing instruction to train you to make wise decisions and be faithful to that principle that you're learning, that your association is helping you to discover. Okay. Got it. More? Sure. But there are other things besides that. That there's adjustments. I mean, not adjustments in details, not in principle. How do you make those decisions? There's principles in making those decisions. So as you go on, someone will help to train you in those. How do you make adjustments in details? There's principles involved in that. I've been trying to give some of them. Like, for example, this thing with eating food, eating foods that are not cooked by devotees. It's not just a flashing yellow light, it's a flashing red light. Stop. Principle. Well, what if, and then what if, and what if, and then, so you go back to a principle. Okay? You'll understand this as you go further. Anything else? My understanding is that's what education is. The question is, in her service, one of her services is working with the Sunday school at the temple with children. She would like very much for the children to have, to carry with them spiritual intelligence. But if part of spiritual intelligence is to say that spirit is over here and matter is over there, matter is temporary, illusory, full of pain, full of suffering, birth, death, disease, and old age, and like kind of the scary picture, to her that's depressing. And she doesn't want to like just depress the kids to get them to be spiritual. So is it possible to impart spiritual understanding to children without all that depressing stuff? Is it important to do so, and can it be done? Can, in principle? There are different ways to do that. And part of the creativity of a teacher to be able to do that, where to be able to impart lessons that are experiential, where the understanding is something like a conclusion that they can come to. I mean, one of the ways that we do that is just storytelling. It's indirect, but it communicates a message. Anyway, rather than going through an inventory list of different creative ways that can be done, it certainly can be done. One of the things, for example, this is part of the inventory list. They're doing this. I was told in Potomac when I was visiting there recently, one of the things they have the children do is they have debates. So the first one they decided to do was vegetarianism. So someone's going to argue, a group of kids are going to argue in favor of not being vegetarian, and some are going to argue in favor of being vegetarian. So they become familiar with the arguments on both sides, because they're going to enter into those kinds of dialogues at some point if they're not already doing it. Then I suggested, what about TV? Somebody argue in favor, you should watch TV. And somebody can argue in favor of, you shouldn't watch TV. Or whatever, you know, you should only watch this or something. Let the kids go through that exercise so it's experiential. Or another in the inventory list is I asked Sridham's son, how does he like school in the suburbs instead of, or you know, outside of Chicago? One of the things he likes is they have a lot of, what do you call those things? Outings? What do you call it? Field trips. Yeah, a lot of field trips. Forget what the other thing. You don't have to wear a uniform to school. That's what he likes about it. You know, from a kid's perspective. So a field trip, but whereby they can discover this opposed to that. So what did we learn today? Like, you know, and a teacher can guide that, but the children can discover. So Prabhupada, Prabhupada was visiting in Bhubaneswar, this is a for example, and one of the highlights in Bhubaneswar, at least at that time, was there's a big Bhubaneswar zoo. So the devotees went through all the things at the Bhubaneswar zoo. And at the end, Prabhupada asked, so what did we learn today? Like a field trip, right, with the Gurukul kids. What did we learn today? And everybody was, you know, looking at each other, and they didn't know what they had learned today. So the Prabhupada said, what we've learned is that intelligence is stronger than brute force. We saw all the strongest animals, wild animals in the jungle, including the lion. There he was in a cage. How did he get inside the cage? Intelligence is stronger. Those simple lessons can be imparted experientially, if you know, in creative ways. Certainly, you know, where values you, which do you value this, or do you value that? Are the best decisions going to be made based on peer pressure because a lot of kids want this or that? You know, there are different ways to creatively impart those lessons, so they can have the reasons why I should choose this instead of that. I mean, that's intelligent, discriminating between things. And why choose a spiritual way of life? That's certainly a part of it. So if you're going to compare and contrast, that's a teaching technique, it's called compare and contrast. So you have to look at the realities of the material side of life. But it's not like you just get a big paint of bucket of black paint and just paint it all black, and then which do you want? White or black? But let them look at some of the realities of material life. What happens to Mother Nature when people become greedy? What's the fruit of greed? And do we want to choose the fruit of greed, or do we want to choose the fruit of respect? And so on. And then they can be given some examples. They can do some role play. This is the concept in Discover. And so it's something that they're feeling, not just something that the teacher says, this is a yes and that's a no. Got it? Repeat after me. This is a yes and that's a no. Okay, you get an A. Next. Is not just recitation, you say, they say, but let them discover, so that when they're in, when you're not in the classroom with them, they're going to choose wisely and have the reasons why. When somebody challenges, why are you choosing that? You should choose this. And they'll have the reasons. I'm never going to choose that because. And be able to withstand the peer pressure that says ignorance and passion. Or not peer pressure, just convenience. Because unmentionables is what's easily available, and so I'll eat unmentionables because it's easily available. I choose. Because I value these principles. I see the outcome over here and I see the outcome over there. I was in California, I was driving, I think it's Route 88, 59 or 88, going from Los Angeles to Bakersfield. I'd been on that route several times, but I did it recently. And on the right-hand side, there's like this really disgusting cattle ranch. I mean, it's like so awful. For miles, it's just animals in mud, eating out of troughs. I mean, just like malicious, unnecessarily malicious. It's just awful. Just to see that. Wow. So, I'm sure that animal rights people have made movement. I mean, you could help the kids do their little presentation on something, give them resources so the other kids can see, because, you know, they just don't know. They just don't know. We had our Gurukula in Lake Huntington. During the summertime, we'd have summer camps, and some kids from the city would go to the summer camp. And I remember this very clearly because I was there the day that they told this one little boy, see that animal over there? That's where milk comes from. It was a cow. He said, stop teasing me. I know where milk comes from. It comes from the supermarket on the corner, and it comes in a little cardboard cart, and that's where milk comes from. And then they showed him wheat. He said, that's where bread comes from. Oh, come on. Cut that. I mean, you know, kids today are so separated from reality. It's such an artificial. And he was commenting, you know, he's from Minnesota, and Nick, and he was commenting, wow, there's no power lines. They're so accustomed to driving and seeing power lines, so they're starting to put power lines under the ground now. Makes it look pristine. But it just looks pristine. No, what's really going on? So let help kids discover what's really going on. What's the reality of a godless civilization? And what's the reality of a God-centered civilization? It's because Prabhupada says, in principle, it's the duty of a spiritual master to systematically train the disciple that this, what the material world really is. It's, as a teacher, it's similar responsibility. What the material world, without, like, you know, just wrenching their minds around into some place of darkness, but just at the same time be real. What happens? What is the consequence of this kind of an approach to nature? The kind of approach to other people? Where is that? What happens? And there are like, bring this thing up with this cattle ranch. There are materials that people who are promoting these views, and you can use those materials to help you in the education process creatively. Krishna eyes them. Anything else? Okay. Hare Krishna. See the Prabhupada. Yeah. Yeah.